Chapter 10. Ruminations on Lyco. The Chew After. The Highest Bidder. Tumultuous sap storms hammered the twist town in the pre-dawn, blanketing the sky with swirling vapors and shaking the tiles and shutters with the gross weight of their heavy, pelting goop. Thunder rolled. In the aftermath, veils of mist swathed the countryside, and the stillness was alive with gurgling and dripping and the swarming scurry of saplice and storm bugs. Nail went out early with Amos and bought paper pails of warm food from the Twist Town commissary just down the street, which was already serving the work lines forming for the shift change in the mills. By the time they returned, we had been joined by Inchabel and Husman, who had slept through the night's altercation with the Arbites in a shared room down the hall. I'd yet to formally notify the Ordo that Inchabel had joined my band, but he was now very much part of it. I felt he had the right to be here on this mission, for Robin's sake, and for his own. He had brought the news of Asaradon to me, directly and selflessly. Few of my team yet referred to him by his rank. It would be a long time until anyone eclipsed the memory of Interrogator Ravenor, but he had meshed well with his bright mind and healthy, caustic wit. He was already providing me with more solid service than Alain von Beg had ever managed. Duj Husman had been a skin hunter on his homeworld of Windhover when Harlan Nail had first met him. That was back in Nail's bounty-chasing days, before he'd joined my cause. I'd recruited Husman 8 years before on Nail's recommendation, and he'd proved to be a resourceful, if superstitious, warrior with a great sense for pathfinding. Nail had personally selected him from the individuals in my retinue as muscle for this venture, and I had no quibble with the choice. Husman was a slender man of medium height with coppery skin and white, sun-scorched hair and goatee. Here on Ichan, like all of us, he'd drabbed down his clothing to ragged black twist robes. He ignored the bundle of disposable wooden forks that Amos had brought back from the commissary and started to eat the hot food from his paper pail with his fingers. I picked at my own food idly, wondering how close we were to Lyco. Lyco had been a fool and had damned himself. The damaging revelation that it hadn't been Asaradon who had been torched on the lawns of the Lang Palace could have been circumvented if Lyco had kept his head. He could have claimed it was a mistake, another example of the heretic Psyker's treachery. But Lyco had run. Out of fear, or chasing some timetable, I didn't know. But he'd run, and in so doing, incriminated himself. I'd gone to his residence, a rented hab, high in the spires of Hive 10, the moment Inchabel had alerted me to the deceit. But Lyco had cleared out, taking his people with him. His hab was empty and abandoned, with just a few scatterings of trash left behind in the stripped rooms. I had set my staff to work tracing him, a tall order given the planet-wide data access problems in the wake of the rioting. I had decided almost at once to pursue him alone, without informing the Inquisition. You may see this as odd, almost reckless. In a way it was. But Lyco was an inquisitor of good repute, held in high regard, and with many friends. There was scant chance I could tell the Ordos I was undertaking a hunt for him on the basis he was harbouring a notorious rogue Psyker, without the fact reaching him, or without his friends making trouble for me. Those friends of his, of course, included Haldane and Commodus Voke, the stalwart trio that had captured the 33 rogues on Dulcine in the first place. How empty that heroic action now seemed to me. I had been so impressed when Lord Rorkan had showed me the report. Perhaps the capture had been easy, or even staged, if Lyco was secretly in league with Asaradon. Perhaps it had all been part of an elaborate conspiracy to perpetrate the atrocity of Hive Primaris. I was dogged by grim, unanswerable speculations. I had no way to prove Lyco was corrupt, not even now, though I certainly suspected it. He might have been an unwitting pawn on Dulcine, or at the Lang Palace, or he might have been in it all along. It was possible, too, that his departure from Thracian was a coincidence that I had misinterpreted. It wouldn't have been the first time an Inquisitor had moved undercover without announcement. It was even possible that he, too, had discovered the deceit after the event, and was moving fast following some lead to make amends for his mistake. Or that he was fleeing the shame. Or so many possibilities. I had to play the odds the safest way. I was sure Lyco was guilty to a greater or lesser extent, so I would follow him, even if he was simply chasing Asaradon too, It would lead me in the right direction. And I couldn't inform the Inquisition, or talk to Voke, or Haldane. My uncertainty was such that I couldn't even trust them not to be part of it. A complex trail of almost subliminal clues had put me on his tail. I'll spare you the bulk of the details, for they would merely document the painstaking tedium that is often the better part of an Inquisitor's work. Suffice to say, we searched and processed Vox logs and the broadcast archives of the local and planetary astropathic guilds. We watched ship transfers, orbital traffic, departure lists, cargo movements. I had personnel in the streets, watching key locations, asking off-the-record questions in trader bars, calling in favours from friends of friends, acquaintances of acquaintances, even one or two old adversaries. I hired trackers and bloodhounders, and took every scent trace I could from Lyko's apartment. I had pheromone codes programmed into servitor skulls that I released into upports and orbital stations. I had well over 100 personnel on my staff, many of them trained hunters, researchers, or surveillancers, but I swear the sheer load of data would have burned out our brains. We would have failed without Amos. My old savant simply rose to the challenge, never put off, never fatigued, his mind soaking in more and more information and making 1,000 mental cross-checks and comparisons every hour, tasks I couldn't have managed in a day with a codifier engine and a datascope. He seemed, damn his old bones, to enjoy it. The clues came in, one by one. A shipment of cargo put into long-term storage in a holding house in Hive 8 and paid for by a debit transfer from one of Lyko's known associates. A 2-second pheromone trace in the departure halls of a commercial port down on the coast of Far Hive Beta. A fuzzy image captured from a Munitorum picked watcher on the streets of Hive Primaris. A passenger on a manifest listing making an unnecessary number of interconnecting flights between upports before moving off planet, as if trying to lose pursuit. Then the key ones. A cursory excise exam of freight that registered the presence of psi-baffling equipment in an off-world shipment. A series of clumsily disguised and presumably hasty bribes to key longshoremen at the Primaris starport. A rogue trader vessel, the Princeps Amalgam, staying a day longer at high anchor than it had logged permission to do, and then a sudden change in its course plans. Instead of a long run to the Asuradai Reef, it was heading spinwards, via Front's World, to the twist farms of Ichan. There was a knock at the room door just after dawn, and I sent everyone except Nail into the adjoining room. Beckwin and Inchabel had the presence of mind to scoop up all the food pails except two. I went over to the window, and Nail sat down in a chair, with his arm casually over the back, so anyone coming in couldn't see the auto-pistol in his hand. I focused my mind for a moment to make sure our twist disguises were live, and then said, "Enter." The door opened, and the porcupine girl from the twist bar came in. She was dressed in a glistening sap cloak, and she looked at us curiously as she pushed back her hood.
"You take your time, Twists," she said.
"You got something, Sweet Jean, or you simply scat to check the good stuff you passed on last night?"
Nail asked with a lascivious smile. She scowled, and a head crest of spines rose in a threat posture.
"I's got a message. You'll know who from."
"The Fant?"
"I ain't saying, Jean Smudge. I just bring it."
"Then spring it."
She reached in her cloak and produced an old, low-tech tracker set, battered and worn. Holding it up briefly, she thumbed it on long enough for us to see the green telltale winking, and then switched it off again and dropped it with a clatter onto the peeling tabletop.
"'S gonna be an auction, bidder's market, so bring lots of yellow," he says. "Lotsa."
"Where? When?"
"Today at shift 2, in the chew after."
"That's to tell you where." "That it?" I asked.
"'S all I have. I just bring it."
She hesitated at the door.
"You might want to make my worthwhile."
I put my hand into my coat pocket and pulled out a single, large denomination imperial coin. "You take these?" Her eyes lit up.
"I take anything."
I tossed it over to her, and she caught it with one hand.
"Thanks," she said.
She went out through the door and then looked back at us, as if my generous contribution to her immediate happiness had shifted her opinion of us, which, sadly, given this miserable place, it probably had.
"Don't trust him," she advised, then closed the door and left.
The Chewafter was the local name given to the tracts of farmland laid waste after the harvesters had been through. Wrecklands of shredded vegetation that began to regrow within days of a harvest, such was the speed and fecundity of Ichan's floral growth. At any one time, there were several thousand square kilometres of Chewafter in the farmlands round the main hive. We headed south, into the most recent areas of Threshwake, following the signal of the tracker. Noon. That was what she had meant by shift two. The second shift change of the day. We gave ourselves 2 hours to get there. On top of all my speculations about Lyco, things still didn't add up. It had been easy enough for Nail to identify Fant Mastic as the local slaver, with a specialization in mind jobs, but why was Lyco using him? Why was Lyco selling a Saradon at all? Amos had suggested it was part of a final trade now that Asaradon had completed his part of their pact. That supposed Lyco was in control, which I doubted. And if he was simply cutting the heretic loose now the work was done, why sell him? Why, indeed, come all this way to do that? Inchabel supposed that maybe Lyco was now anxious to get rid of the rogue Psyker because he was afraid of him. I had my own theory. Lyco had brought Asaradon to Ichan for some other purpose, and arranging a mock sale through the Fant was simply bait to draw anyone who might have followed him out into the open. As it turned out, I was right. I wasn't surprised. It's what I would have done. The Chewafter was a miasmal waste, as far as the eye could see, which wasn't far at all given the clinging sap mists from the night before. The land was a gouged, punished ruin of ripped shoots, shredded plant fibre, wrenched-up root balls and pressure-flattened soil. The massive track marks of the harvesters had left wide ruts, the depth of a man's waist, at the bottom of which plant material and soil was layered into a glassy flatness like they had been set in aspic. The misty air was wet with sap, and everything was crawling with lice motes and storm bugs. They swarmed in the air, settled all over us, and we could feel them in our clothes. By then, although we maintained our twist disguises, we were all armed and armoured at full strength. One doesn't walk into a likely trap with a black powder pistol and a sharp stick. I wore body armour and carried my power sword and bolt pistol. The others were similarly heavy with battle gear. If we were caught now, maintaining the pretense we were twists would be the last of our problems. 10 kilometres south, through the swirling, sticky mists, we could hear the chugging, rending sounds of the harvesters as they moved on their way. Every few metres there was another bloody smear or furry pulp, the remains of crop rodents caught in the reaping blades of the factory machines.
"You'd think," said Inchabel, pausing to wipe the gooey sweat from his face, "that the wildlife would have got used to the farm factories by now, learned to get out of the way."
"Some things never learn," Husman muttered. "Some things always come back to the source." "He means food. He always means food,"
Nail chuckled to me.
"To Dutch, everything comes back to food."
"According to mill statistics," said Amos, "there are 4 billion crop rats in every demi-terre of field space. Rivers of them flee before the harvesters. We've seen one rat corpse for every 22 metres, which suggests only 2.2% of them were unlucky enough to be caught in the blades. That means the vast percentage fled. They're smarter than you think."
He paused. Everyone had stopped and was staring at him.
"What?" he asked. "What? I was only saying—"
"That old geezer fantasizes about maths and stats more than I fantasize about the ladies,"
Nail told Beckwin as we moved forward again.
"I'm not sure which of you I'm supposed to feel more sorry for," she said.
Husman held up the tracker the porcupine girl had given us and shook it. Then he slapped it a couple of times for good measure. We waded through the plant fibre and came level with him. "Problem?" I asked.
"Damn thing. Too old."
"Let me see it." Husman handed it to me. It was a piece of crap, all right. Battered by a lifetime of hard knocks, with a nearly flat power cell. A nice touch, that, I thought, noting Lyco's careful planning. An unreliable tracker made this seem so much more genuine. A brand new or well-powered unit would have been as good as a written invitation beginning, "Dear people chasing me, please come here and get killed." I shook the device myself and got a good return, just enough juice to lead us to our deaths. "That way," I said. It was close to noon. The sun was up, but the sap mists hadn't dissipated, We were bathed in a warm, yellow, filmy glare. According to the tracker, we are about half a kilometre away from the auction site. They're expecting me and Nail, so we'll go in with Beckwin. I wanted an untouchable close to me. Inchmel, cut east with Amos. Husman, west. Covering positions. Don't move in unless you hear me vox a direct command. Understand? The three nodded. If you find anything, keep it glossier and keep it brief. Go. Nathan Inchabel armed his las carbine and moved away to the left with Amos, along a harvester track bed, leaving tacky footprints in the glassy, crushed residue at the bottom of the huge rut. Husband's hemp-cloth-wrapped long las was already armed. He darted away to the right, quickly lost in the mist. "Shall we?" I said to Beckwin and Nail.
"After you,"
Nail grinned. I made one long last command by Vox, in glossier code, and we trudged into the ripped thickets of the Chewafter. The Fant's people had used flamers to clear a wide space in the morass of the Chewover. We could smell the burnt pulp fibre from several dozen metres away. The mist was still close, but I could make out several crop runner trucks, skimmers and land speeders parked in the blackened clearing. People bustled around them. "What do you see?" I asked Nail. He played his magnoculars round again.
"Fant and his twist cronies. The horned guy and that eyeball creep. Maybe a dozen, some of whom think they're hidden around the perimeter. Plus, the prospective bias. I make four all hive types, with minders. 16 other bodies, all told."
I yanked up my hood. "Come on.
There's an alarm strand round the site.
We'll trip it. That's what it's there for." The alarm strand was an ankle-high wire cord tied taut between the churned root clumps. Every meter or so, the air-dried shell case of a storm bug was carefully tied to it, forming a little hollow-sounding bell. They rattled and jangled as we deliberately plucked the wire. In a moment, ragged-robed twist muscle loomed out of the murdered undergrowth, aiming matchlocks and blades at us. "We're here for the auction," I told them, holding up Fant's tracker. "Sinvited."
"Nay,"
croaked a frog-headed thing with a crossbow and a spittle problem. "Igo, from off, with his twists." Froghead waved us into the site. The others assembled before the low flakboard stage on which Fant Mastic stood, looking round at us.
"Igo, off-world twist, with two others,"
Froghead announced. Fant nodded his heavy, tusked head, and Froghead and his men backed off, putting up their weapons.
"S'glad you could make it, twist."
"You the Fant. You the twist with the stuff, but I share my own name loud, not these others."
"Let's all be known, then the sale can begin."
Fant looked down at the other buyers. One, a stunning female upspire hiver, in a tight body glove, nodded.
"Frovis Vasik,"
she said through a panlingual servitor skull drone that floated at her shoulder. She was clearly speaking some high-caste dialect, cant, dilettante wealthers, would-be cultist types, well-armed and armoured with all the war gear spire money could afford.
"Murdoch,"
said the next, a frail, white-suited elderly man, leaning on a cane and wiping perspiration from his brow with a Japananga lace kerchief that had cost more than the lowly Fant's entire outfit. He had four minders, squat females in rubberized war arena suits, each with an electronic slave-leash collar around her throat.
"Tanselman Fibes,"
said the bland-faced man to Murdoch's left, stepping forward with a courteous nod. He was dressed in a bright orange cooler suit, with large, articulated exchanger veins sprouting from his shoulders. His breath smoked in the personal veil of cold air the suit was generating around him. He was also alone, which made him instantly more dangerous than the hive retards who had brought muscle.
"You may address me as Erotic,"
said the last, a bitch-faced crone who had inadvisably wedged her ancient body into a close-fitting, spiked black body glove, the mark of a death cultist. Or would-be death cultist, I thought. She had five masked and harnessed slaves with her, all of them sweating in the misty heat. I saw at once they were out of their depth. They played at death cult, up in the eyries of the main hive, maybe cutting their skin and drinking blood once in a while. The closest they had come to a real death cult was watching some blurry fake snuff picked to impress their friends after a banquet. "Screech you all. I'm Igor, Softworld, and twisted as they come. I bowed. Fibes and Vasek returned the motion. Murdoch mopped his brow, an erotic gesture, a very ham-fisted sign of the true death, which nearly made Nail laugh out loud.
"Can we get started, my friend Fant?"
Murdoch asked, dabbing his kerchief around the sweat runs on his face.
"It's midday, and bloody hot out here."
"And I have murders to do, and blood to drink,"
Erotic cried. Her plump and unhealthy minders oohed and aahed and tried to get their nipple spikes and bondage straps comfortable.
"Oh, dear God, Emperor, they're never going to make it out alive," whispered Beckwin.
"More fool them," I whispered back.
Fant's men used force poles and electro-lashes to goad the sail item from the back of a crop-runner truck onto the stage. It was a rangy human, straight-jacketed and blindfolded, with a heavy psychic damper muzzle buckled around his head.
"Alpha plus quality, one only. Smids, now."
10 bars,
cried Erotic at once.
20, said Vasek.
25,
cried Murdoch. Fibes cleared his throat. His cough blew cold steam out from the private atmosphere generated by his suit.
"I think that's established the common level here. I do hate mixing with proles. 1,000 bars.
Erotic and her minders gasped. Murdoch looked pale. Vasek glanced round at Fibes with a curt look.
At least someone sees the true worth of the item on sale. Good. We can begin serious bidding."
Vasek cleared her throat, and her cyber skull dutifully issued white noise.
1,200 bars, she said.
1,300,
Erotic cried out, desperately.
15, said Murdoch. My best offer. I had no idea this meat would be so hungry, or so rich.
2,000,
said Vasek's hovering skull.
3,
said Fibes. Murdoch was already shaking his head. Erotic was walking away towards the edge of the site, complaining loudly to her pudgy sex toys, who bustled around her.
3,500, said Vasek.
4,
said Fibes.
Anything? I whispered to Beckwin. Not even the slightest latent push.
But those baffles could be doing their job.
So it could be a Saradon?
Yes.
I doubt it, but it could.
Nail? Harlan Nail looked round at me.
Nothing. The Fant's minders are getting edgy because the old witch and her sad hump muffins are trying to leave before the auction's finished. But nothing else. 5,500,
Vasek's servitor skull rasped.
6,
said Fibes. Murdoch had withdrawn to one side of the site with his minders and was taking a sustaining puff of obscura from a portable water pipe one of the Warina slave femmes was holding for him. Erotic and her chubby concubines were arguing with Hornhead and another couple of twists on the other side of the burned acre.
8,500,
Vasek was announcing.
9, returned Fibes.
50, I said quietly, tossing a huge pile of ingots down onto the stained soil. There was a pause, a long, damned pause.
50 bid.
Fant looked down at us all. Murdoch and Erotic and all their people were simply dumbstruck. Vasek turned away, screaming, and her minders had to hold her down as she went into fits of rage. Fibes just looked at me, his breath coming slow and short in clouds.
50, he said.
S50. Count 'em. You got better?
What if I have, Igor?
Please, stop it with the stupid twist talk. It's getting on my nerves.
Fibes walked towards me. He reached up and pulled his face off. The flesh disintegrated like gossamer as he pulled it away, revealing his blank, piercing eyes.
Oh, Gregor, you do so like to make an entrance, don't you?
Said Cherubael.